Okay, I'm going to talk about some work I did on semi-classical string theory and the ADS-CFT correspondence, which appeared last year in a paper, and there was a follow-up paper with my student Manuel Losi, some of which I might get on to talk about.
0905.xxx.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I've been teaching this year, so that's a poor excuse. That's why there aren't any 09s, but... Oh, no. I could talk about some work in progress, and maybe I'll get there, but I rarely get to that part of the talk, so... Okay, so at its heart, ADS-CFT contains a mysterious strong weak coupling duality, the duality in the Toft coupling. Specifically, if we think about the ADS-CFT correspondence for the strict large n limit of the n equals 4 theory, it maps it onto free string theory on ADS-5 cross S5, and of course, although the strings are free in that they don't interact with each other, there's still a very hard problem to be solved to find the spectrum of a single free string associated with solving the world sheet signal model. And therein lies the problem, because we have a parameter on both sides of the correspondence, the Toft coupling of the n equals 4 Super-Yang-Mills theory, which is inversely related to the sigma model coupling. And basically, the way the duality works is that it's a weak strong duality in the Toft coupling. We have two very different regimes where the basic degrees of freedom of the theory look very different. In the limit of small Toft coupling, we're in the usual domain of perturbative gauge theory, and the basic degrees of freedom are the gauge variant, gluons, and superpartners of the n equals 4 theory. Whereas if we go to very large values of the Toft coupling, the weakly coupled degrees of freedom are, of course, closed strings moving in the ADS5 cross S5 background. So one of the most fascinating questions about this duality between these two theories is, as we reduce the Toft coupling from very large values to very small values, how exactly is it that gauge theory partons emerge from the string? How can it possibly be that the string, which is some closed smooth object, gives rise to the degrees of freedom of a free gauge theory, ultimately in the limit that lambda goes to zero? Well, it could be that question is just very hard and we need to solve the world sheet signal model exactly to answer it. But another possibility, which I find quite interesting and exciting, is that there is, like many other strong weak coupling dualities, there is some sense in which you can expect to find the basic degrees of freedom of one description as collective modes or solitonic excitations of another, like the Sine-Gordon-Turing equivalence or other dualities of that sort, the S-duality of n equals 4 itself. And along these lines, there's a very beautiful suggestion, a partial suggestion about how to understand how partons emerge from, I use the word parton loosely just to mean the free quanta of the dual gauge theory, how partons emerge from the closed string. So the idea originates in the work of Krzyzewski, but it's received a lot of amplification and echoes in the recent work of Alday and Maldacena on gluon scattering, and I think also to some extent in Joe's work with Matt Strassler on deep and elastic scattering in ADS-CFT. And the idea is this, that basically when the parton is very energetic, and specifically here I'll be thinking about string states which rotate so they carry large spins, so when the parton is very energetic, carries a large angular momentum on the dual three-sphere, for example, then it should be somehow related to a region or spike of the string which approaches the boundary, so a point on the string which approaches the boundary. Now there's some sense in which this kind of recipe has to be right, because if you take the limit in which the energy of the parton becomes infinite, you can basically think about it as something like a light-like Wilson line in the gauge theory, and that's the limit in which these spikes would actually touch the boundary, and you can see that the recipe you would get of having light-like trajectories on the boundary with a string drooping into the interior closely resembles the standard recipe for a Wilson line. So something like this, I think, has to be right. But what I want to do in this talk is to try and go beyond that and talk about the sort of somehow the leading dynamics beyond that limit of very, very large spin, where the spikes are a little bit in from the boundary and they they actually do correspond to dynamical degrees of freedom rather than static external sources, as they would be if they actually touched the boundary. So, as I said, the idea originates in some work of Kruschensky, and basically in his paper he just presented some very special solutions of classical string theory on ADS, which have a fixed number of spikes, and those spikes it's a kind of rigidly rotating string, and the characteristic is that the spikes are at the vertices of a regular polygon, so they're rather special solutions. So what I'm actually going to try and do is to talk about this type of solution more generally, and in fact actually analyze generic states in semi-classical string theory and how they behave in this limit. And what we're going to find is a nice and very tight connection between the dynamics of these spikes and the gauge theory spin chain in this limit. Okay, so the plan of the talk is as follows. I'm going to begin by discussing basically the limit that we're interested in here, which is the limit of large spin on the gauge theory side. Large, if you think about it in terms of states, large angular momentum around the equator of the three sphere on which the gauge theory lives. And I'm going to first of all review the what we know about that in gauge theory. There's a lot of beautiful work that even predates the existing gold rush in integrability in n equals 4, because in fact this s goes to infinity limit. A lot of the behavior you see is actually universal, at least at one loop, and is kind of applies also to QCD, and there were some very beautiful ideas and papers produced in the mid-90s by Korchemsky and collaborators in the context of QCD. So the main part of the talk will be to describe how we analyze this limit in semi-classical string theory, so on the dual side of the correspondence. And here we're going to really rely heavily on the exact integrability of the classical equations of motion of string theory on the dual background. So the main result, which I hope to get to by the end of the talk, is actually quite a strong one. What I'll show is that in the large S limit, the semi-classical spectrum of string theory, for reasonably generic states, which I'll describe, is actually in precise agreement with the one-loop spectrum of the gauge theory in the same limit. And that includes not just the leading order in S, but the first subleading term, which contains the interesting dynamics that I want to get my hands on. And in fact, this is a priori, because it will be a weak, strong coupling situation. You might think that such an agreement is unexpected, but I'll try and kind of make it more expected and discuss it in the context of what we know about the two systems as I get to the end of the talk. And then the final part of the talk, if I get there, will be to try and tie these things together and actually use this correspondence to relate the basic degrees of freedom of the spiky string and the spin chain. Okay, so first off, let's review what's known in gauge theory. N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, weak coupling. I'm going to focus on a set of operators which are generic in the sense that they're not BPS, but they're, and in fact, there are versions of this story that I could tell you about generic single trace operators in the spectrum of N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, but this is a very convenient subset because they're characterized by just two quantum numbers. The twist of the operator in the QCD language is the number of scalar fields which are inserted here. So Z is one of the three complex adjoint scalars of the N equals 4 theory. And we also have in the operator an arbitrary number of a single component of the covariant derivative. It's a light-like component of the covariant derivative where you pick one light-like vector in Minkowski space and just pick that derivative so that it carries spin 1 under a particular subgroup of the four-dimensional conformal group. So this set of operators has these two quantum numbers, and it's convenient because of quantum numbers, when you consider renormalization and anomalous dimensions, these operators only mix amongst each other. They don't mix with the other operators of the N equals 4 theory. So the three quantum numbers are the twist J, or RU1R charge, the spin, which is just the number of derivatives, and classically the dimension of the operator is just the sum of S and J, the total number of derivatives plus fields inserted. So now, importantly, the limit I want to study is somewhat orthogonal to where the bulk of progress has been in the story of understanding operator dimensions. The bulk of progress has been in the limit where we think about very long operators, where the number of Zs sense, becomes very large, and that corresponds to some kind of macroscopic thermodynamic limit in the spin chain picture. Here I'll be considering something quite different, where I keep the R charge fixed, the length of the chain fixed in the language of spin chains, and instead take the number of derivatives to infinity. And we'll see that this limit has quite a different character to the limits that are conventionally thought about. So let's start at the beginning, and the simplest result is if you look at the sector of lowest twist, that's twist 2, we're basically up to conformal descendants. There is essentially just a single operator to look at involving 2 z's and lots of derivatives. And the basic result, which is characteristic of its universal engaged theories, non-abelian engaged theories, is that in this particular limit, this operator at one loop acquires an anomalous dimension, and the characteristic feature is that the anomalous dimension grows logarithmically with the spin. So this is something, in fact, that predates any study of n equals 4. It was originally important in the context of deep inelastic scattering to understand how these kind of operators in QCD with gluons rather than scalars inserted in them contribute in deep inelastic scattering. So the result is log S scaling with some prefactor, which I'll just call gamma. It's a function that crops up in lots of different places in the n equals 4 theory. But here I just mean the result of the one loop computation plus possibly higher order corrections. So now, of course, on the dual side of the correspondence, when we think about strings on ADS5 process 5, one of the early successes in understanding the relationship between strings and gauge theory operators was the fact that this log S scaling can be reproduced very nicely, very easily on the string theory side by thinking about the lowest Regge trajectory, just thinking about the simplest, lowest energy folded spinning string in an ADS3 subspace of ADS5 process 5. So this is a limit where the spin string basically has just 2 quantum numbers, its energy with respect to the global time in ADS3, and its angular momentum, which is just the rotational angle in this particular slice of ADS3. And of course, the famous result of Gubser, Klebanov, and Polyakov is that unlike the flat space story where you would get the usual Regge trajectory, here you get a very interesting behavior which in fact matches the expectation from gauge theory. You find this log S divergence in the energy minus the spin of the corresponding string state. Of course, there's a very different prefactor because this is a calculation undertaken at large Toft coupling, so it scales like square root lambda. And one of the big successes of the last few years of the integrability boom is that we naturally now believe we know this function exactly as something that interpolates between the anomalous dimension I showed you on the previous slide and the energy of the string state here. So the basic phenomenon which gives you the log S is the fact that as the string spins, its endpoints become further and further apart, and the log S behavior is associated with the limit where the endpoints approach the boundary of ADS5.
Is that exactly known by now? I mean,
it's a very well-tested conjecture. Let's put it that way. It's essentially, I'd say it's, it's always assuming the exact integrability of n equals 4 super Young Mills in this limit. And if you assume that, then I think it's rapidly approaching a kind of direct consequence of that. Not quite there yet, but essentially that's the only assumption involved. So what happens at higher twist? Well, then the situation gets more interesting because you don't just have one operator to think about. You have a whole complicated spectrum of operators corresponding to the fact that there are lots of inequivalent ways to distribute those derivatives between the different fields in the operator. So this is going to be a limit where we think about the number of derivatives on each site becoming suitably large. And one can describe that very nicely on the spin chain, in the spin chain language that has been so useful in describing the spectrum of operator dimensions in the last few years. So in fact, what we're doing here is considering, in general, if we consider this sector, it's some kind of non-compact SL2R spin chain with an SL2R representation at each site of the chain. Now, as I said before, the popular limit to consider over the last few years has been the limit where the length of this spin chain becomes very long and you go over to a kind of non-compact situation in which you can talk about factorized scattering and all those things. I'm instead going to consider the limit where the number of derivatives becomes large. That corresponds to a limit where the SL2R spin at each site becomes very, very highly excited. It has a single raising operator at each site, and we're going to pile that on so it's very, very heavily excited. And basically, you can describe that limit in a very straightforward way as saying that it's the limit in which the quantum spin chain, which describes the full one-loop spectrum, goes over to a classical spin chain. So what do I mean by a classical spin chain? I mean that we assign to each site of the chain, insertion of the field here, a classical spin, which is something valued in the Lie algebra of SL2R, which is the classical limit of the quantum spin that appears in the usual spin chain formulation. And by that I mean that rather than having spin operators whose commutators give you the SL2R algebra, spin algebra, here the algebra is realized in terms of the Poisson brackets of these classical variables. Now, the key calculation, which was done a long time ago by Belitsky and Korchemsky and people in the context of QCD, is exactly the same as the N equals 4 theory in this particular limit, for this particular sector, is that the anomalous dimension can be related to a particular pairwise interaction between these classical spins. It's pairwise, just as in the usual spin chain story, one loop is always pairwise because of the planarity of the diagrams. So here you have a very specific form of interaction between these nearest neighbor sites on the spin chain. And of course, the key feature is that of this Hamiltonian is that it's an exactly integrable system.
Is this, does this Hamiltonian require the spins to be classical, or is there, you could have...
No, actually, that you can write down, in general, you have the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which is it involves a digamma function of the spin operators. So when you take this limit that the spin becomes large, as well as replacing the operators by classical variables, the scaling actually simplifies the form of the Hamiltonian, and psi digamma goes over to a pure logarithm in this limit.
Where does the non-compactness enter in driving this result?
Non-compactness, this result would actually apply equally if I was considering... It's non-compactness enters crucially because if I had a compact spin chain, I would only have a finite number of states, and I would not be able to take any classical limit without changing the representation. If you're thinking about a non-compact spin chain, then you have an SL2R algebra with an infinite number of states where you can apply the raising operator an infinite number of times, and it's that limit that gives you the classical behavior. So there simply is no corresponding limit for a compact spin chain.
Sorry, just again. So you said that the quantum spin chain would have a digamma function or whatever, but
of the nearest neighbor spin operators. Neighbor. Yes. So yes. 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 Exactly.
The term spin, it means that you're talking about a single representation of SL2R at each site.
Yes, yes. So we're preserving the Casimir of the representation, and that's the reason I've drawn this as a cone in this particular limit. These satisfy Casimir algebra, Casimir relation, which is effectively that of spin zero, because we've gone to a classical limit where the number of units of J that you have is invisible. So that's why, roughly speaking, these things live on a cone at each site.
Integrable as well?
Oh, yeah. The full spin chain is integrable. But in this particular limit, it's actually the integrability is more universal than it is in N equals 4 super Yang Mills. So, for example, this is true of wide classes of different operators in QCD, for example, at one loop also. They have universal asymptotics in this large spin limit. So here, you could approach this in N equals 4 just simply by taking the beta ansatz and taking the appropriate limit. But it'll be more interesting for making contact with string theory to understand a little bit about the solution, although I don't think I'm going to have a chance to say very much given the time. So as I said, basically the story is that in this limit you have a classical spin chain, some nonlinear system describing the interactions of these spins, but the key feature, it's integrable. There are a hierarchy of Poisson commuting conserved charges that allow you to find in the usual way action angle variables in terms of which the dynamics linearizes, and everything can can be solved for arbitrary initial data. So in fact, what you want to do to get the leading spectrum of operators in this limit is not just the classical limit. You want to apply the first WKB quantization to that limit to give you a discrete spectrum. So that corresponds to taking this classical chain and applying Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization to the various periodic orbits under which it goes, and then you get the leading large S asymptotics of the spectrum of anomalous dimensions. So I won't say too much more about this, other than the fact that there are some characteristic features. The key feature is that the resulting spectrum of dimensions you find, it lies in a band, and the band is bounded below by the lowest twist operator that we talked about already. Its dimension 2 gamma log S was the dimension of just the operator of twist 2, but now there's a whole band which goes up to J times gamma log S. So you replace the 2 associated with the two insertions with the J associated with the fact that we have J scalar fields in this operator. I wish I had time to describe this in a little bit more detail, but it will be important for the story to note that solution is essentially given, determined by a particular hyperelliptic Riemann surface. I'll just say something very quickly about that for the aficionados. So it's a specific curve whose coefficients are the Poisson commuting charges of the system, and its relevance is that it allows you to find the appropriate action angle variables for the system. Specifically, if you think about the solution in terms of action angle variables, it's naturally described as free motion on the Jacobian variety, in other words, the associated period torus of this particular curve. So its significance is that it generates the action angle variables for you, and you can also describe this semi-classical quantization as a quantization of the moduli of this curve in a very straightforward way, and maybe we'll come back to that as the talk progresses. But the key thing here is that we have a specific one-loop prediction which lies in this band between 2 log S and J log S in units of gamma. So now, what about the partons that I talked about in the opening part of the talk? What has this got to do with partons, free quanta of the gauge field? Well, to understand that, it's useful to actually switch from the perspective of operators, the spectrum of operators in Minkowski space, to the equivalent perspective of thinking about states, energy eigenstates of the n equals 4 theory on a free sphere, so the usual state operator correspondence. So if we think about the state in the Hilbert space of the n equals 4 and 3 sphere that correspond to this particular operator, well, first of all, in free field theory, it's straightforward to see that basically the fact that we have J of these Zs will lead to J quanta living on this 3 sphere. So the dots here are supposed to represent quanta of the field Z, the particular scalar field Z, and the derivatives in the operator correspond to the corresponding quantum number on S3, which is the angular momentum that these quanta have when they rotate around, when they traverse the equator, an appropriately chosen equator of this 3 sphere. So these quanta, of course, are blurry and their wave functions spread out, but it's convenient to think about them in a sort of semi-classical way. When their energies become large, you can effectively think about them in some kind of iconal approximation. They approach, static world lines in the limit, but their energies become very large. So we're thinking about some state that consists of J quanta, and you can ask what happens to this state as you include the various interactions, as you go beyond just the free field theory. Well, basically what happens, at least as long as these quanta are suitably energetic, qualitatively what happens is, of course, that each of these quanta is some kind of a source for the other fields, in particular the gauge field, so you expect there will be some kind of flux lines emanating from each of these quanta, and the way the operator is arranged, the fact that it's a single trace operator, implies, at least qualitatively, that it should look something like the following: that we have some set of highly energetic quanta, and then we have some flux tubes joining them. And of course, those will be very fat flux tubes because we're in the n equals 4 theory, where the dynamics is not confining; it's a Coulomb's law dynamics. So the flux lines spread out, but they have to run from one source to the corresponding sink. So that's sort of the qualitative picture of what this operator corresponds to in terms of the state on the three-sphere. An interesting point, which is quite important, I think, but I'm not going to rely on too heavily, is you might think that if I go beyond free field theory, the number of quanta can change. You might think that in particular I could introduce pairs of Z and Z bar quanta without changing the charge of the state, and that would be a very natural thing. But in fact, for this particular set of operators, that doesn't happen. Specifically, as I said, the key fact is that these operators only mix among themselves under renormalization. So in fact, in this particular instance, it is true that the number of quanta of the Z field is actually a conserved quantum number in this sector. And the Hamiltonian that you compute order by order just mixes those states associated with those J quanta. So what about the dual string picture? Well, this is, I guess, where Kruschensky's picture starts to look very reasonable and very plausible, in that this indeed looks very much like the holographic dual of the picture of the state that I've drawn up there. Specifically, in place of the quanta, which are sort of in some limit where they become highly energetic, we have the spikes, which are points that are very, very close to the boundary and would ultimately become points on the boundary when the energy of the quanta becomes infinite, and they become basically like Wilson lines. And in between each of the quanta, we have a region where the string droops into the interior of ADS 5. And that's quite reasonable in terms of the picture that I've drawn out, because, of course, the characteristic behavior of flux lines in the Coulomb phase is that they spread out, and that's supposed to be the holographic dual of a string drooping into the interior. So at least qualitatively, this picture looks like it should be the right thing to think about. In terms of quantitative analysis, Kruschensky presented a single, I should say that somehow these ideas aren't really, you couldn't literally read them out of his paper, but they're certainly sort of somehow what his paper, the picture that his paper implies and has been alluded to by several other people. But in his paper, he presents just some specific solutions. So those specific solutions are just rigidly rotating solutions where the spikes are distributed at the vertices of a regular polygon. I haven't drawn that very well. It doesn't look very regular, but it's supposed to be regular. So we have a rigidly rotating string with k cusps. There is nothing particularly singular. Before we take the large spin limit, nothing particularly singular happens at the cusps. They're just points where the derivative of the world sheet fields along the string, just like the ordinary folded string, where that derivative vanishes. So it doesn't correspond a priori to any singularity in any conserved charge or anything carried by the string. The singularity occurs once the points approach the boundary of ADS, and that corresponds to the log S. Now, of course, because we have K spikes here, it's entirely natural that, like the folded string which gave us 2 gamma log S, this will give us K gamma log S, and that indeed is the right scaling for the state at the top of this band of operators that I've described if you identify K with J. So it's a reasonable starting point to think that this string, this particular solution, might have something to do with the state at the top of the band of operators that I've described, and that somehow you should identify the number of spikes with the number of quanta in the dual state, which in this particular case that I'm thinking about is the R charge J. So I should say that's kind of subtle, because the U1R charge, if we hold that fixed, some fixed number of units of J, then it becomes, as we scale the spin to infinity and take the large lambda limit, that quantum number becomes invisible. You can't, this string solution that I'm actually showing you here is moving purely in ADS3. It doesn't move on S5, so it doesn't have any classical amount of the R charge associated with that motion. But the idea is somehow that the fact that the dual state contains J quanta is somehow encoded in the fact that the resulting string solution has a fixed number of spikes. Okay, so that's the first part of the talk. That's sort of a review of sort of the existing, what was known basically, the existing knowledge about these string solutions. So now I want to shift gear and talk about what one can do if one thinks about generic string states with the right quantum numbers. After all, we had some very large set of operators characterized by these two quantum numbers, and we expect that we'll correspondingly have some large set of string solutions associated with these quantum numbers corresponding to classical strings. And as these strings will carry, I want to let them carry both R charge in general and angular momentum in ADS3, I'll think about bosonic strings moving on ADS3 cross S1. And basically what I want to do is to use the integrability of the classical equations of motion to actually analyze generic solutions in the limit of very, very large spin. That's the restriction to just thinking about, on the gauge theory side, we just thought about operators that carry one of the spins of the superconformal algebra, and in fact, in general, one of the U1 R charges. So the fact that we're thinking about operators that only carry one spin basically corresponds to restricting to an ADS3 submanifold of ADS5, at least at this classical level. Of course, quantum mechanically, the string fluctuates in all directions, but I'm really only thinking about the leading classical and leading semi-classical dynamics at the level of Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization, where it makes sense to restrict to these subspaces which are characterized by the quantum numbers you're interested in.
As you said, since the string, the spiky string, doesn't move in the S5,
yes,
wouldn't it have been more natural to compare it to gauge theory operators which involve high spins but acting on the gauge fields?
That's right, but there are technical reasons why that's very, very difficult. You have to find a nice... You're just thinking about strings moving in ADS5 without any motion on the S5. And that's technically very difficult because you have to find the right gauge in which to think about string solutions on ADS5. And this formulation of string theory, which I'm going to describe, is not nearly as well developed in the situation in which you choose some light cone gauge in ADS rather than a gauge where you have some motion on the S1. So what I'm going to do here is think about states with some fixed value of J. It doesn't matter what that is, as long as we hold that fixed and take the limit where the spin goes to infinity. The important thing will be that the ratio of J over S goes to zero. And I should say also that as far as these spiky strings are concerned, an important thing to remember is that it's not quite as simple as saying that J has to match the number of spikes, because on the gauge theory side, for any fixed value of J, the spin chain contains kind of sort of subsets within its Hilbert space which correspond to shorter chains. So you can actually turn one of the spins off. So a given value of J will actually give rise to sectors with all lower numbers of behavior characterized by any multiple of log S that you, any integral multiple of log S that you like. So we're doing what we can here, which is basically to look at generic string solutions in the case initially where they'll carry quantum numbers both with respect to ADS3 and with respect to S1. And then we're going to take the limit where the spin goes to infinity but hold the charge fixed as far as the motion on S1 is concerned. And the reason that S1 is convenient is because you can do the standard thing in this game, which is to choose a static conformal gauge for the string motion on the S1, which effectively eliminates the S1 and reduces the classical dynamics essentially to that of the principal chiral model for the group SL2R. It's principal chiral model for SL2R just because SL2R group manifold is basically the same thing as ADS3, and the ordinary sigma model with target space ADS3 is then very naturally rewritten in terms of a group-valued field which lives in the group SL2R, and then you can rewrite the Lagrangian in this simple way in terms of the light cone components of the corresponding Noether current associated with, in fact, right multiplication in the group SL2R. J is a current associated with the isometries, therefore, of ADS3, and it contains information about the quantum numbers of the string. So, of course, we're considering string theory in a curved background, so the equations of motion are highly nonlinear. But the key feature here is a feature that was appreciated a long time ago by Pollmeyer and Lucia, the fact that the dynamics is actually integrable. The principal chiral model is integrable in the sense that you can reformulate its nonlinear equation of motion as the consistency condition for an auxiliary linear problem. So basically, that means that we can find a pair of linear differential operators that depend on the currents and also depend on an auxiliary spectral parameter called x. In fact, it's going to be important that this is singular at the points x equals plus and minus 1. You can move those singularities around, but this scheme always has some singularities in this auxiliary differential equation. So we have two linear differential operators, and the precise statement is that the original equations of motion of the SL2R sigma model are completely equivalent to demanding that these two differential operators commute with each other. In other words, they can consistently admit a simultaneous eigenfunction for all values of the spectral parameter. Said another way, you can think about the constant parts of, or the non-derivative parts of these operators as defining a one-parameter family of flat SL2R connections on the world sheet. If you like, a gauge field on the world sheet of zero field strength. So the significance of that is that it leads immediately to this infinite tower of conserved charges associated with the string dynamics. There's a standard construction, which is to take that lax current, as it's called, composed from the parts of those two differential operators, and form something called the monodromy matrix, which is basically, if you think about the current as, if you think about it as giving rise to a gauge field on the world sheet, this is just the Wilson line of this gauge field around a closed loop on the world sheet. And the significance of this construction is that the flatness of the current that appears in the exponent here immediately leads to a nice property of this matrix, specifically the property that as we evolve in time, the eigenvalues of the matrix are conserved. In other words, the matrix evolves purely by conjugation. So that's a consequence of flatness of the current, and the corresponding statement is that it gives rise to a one-parameter family of conserved charges on the world sheet. So specifically, if we take this monodromy matrix and we look at its eigenvalues, they are eigenvalues of an SL2R matrix, so it's convenient to parameterize them into terms of an object P of X called the quasi-momentum, and the statement that P of X basically gives rise to a one-parameter family of conserved quantities. If you Taylor expand P of X around any point in the spectral plane, each term in the Taylor expansion is a new conserved charge built out of the world sheet fields. And of course, the fact that this construction applies to the full ADS5 cross S5 string background was shown by Joe with Benner and Roiban back in 2003, I think. So it's something that generalizes to semi-classical string theory on full ADS5 cross S5 background, although here we're just focusing on a sort of submanifold. So this is rather abstract because it gives you these charges and it's not immediately apparent what to do with these charges. If you look at the auxiliary linear problem, you can also characterize the monodromy matrix as being associated with what happens under a periodic shift of the world sheet coordinate as for the solution of that auxiliary linear problem. So the key feature of this construction is the existence of this auxiliary parameter x. And it turns out that you can get huge mileage just from analyzing the analytic properties of the basic objects which appear in the construction as functions of this parameter x. The first thing is that lambda plus and minus are eigenvalues of a 2x2 matrix. So it's very natural, as the matrix depends holomorphically on x, that the eigenvalues which come from solving a quadratic equation will naturally live on a double cover of the x-plane. So in fact, the most general possible behavior that you can have for this quasi-momentum for any given solution can be analyzed, and it involves possibly an infinite number of cuts in the x-plane, which on which the two eigenvalues represent the two sheets. There are also a pair of singularities that appear on both sheets. They're actually essential singularities of the eigenvalues, which are inherited from the singularities of the Lax connection. So that can be gained from just analyzing the possible behaviors, but a much more powerful statement is that you can actually start from a given set of analytic properties for P and reconstruct a string solution from that, that there is actually effectively a one-to-one map between, in fact, families of string solutions characterized by different initial conditions but with the same conserved quantities, and this data encoded in the analytic properties of this quasi-momentum. And this, although it looks very abstract, is actually something quite natural in string theory. It's really nothing other than a nonlinear analog of the mode expansion in string theory. And you can see that most clearly when you shrink these cuts down to zero size and look what happens to the corresponding solution. It is nothing other than a point-like string. It's the ground state of the string. In fact, it's the BMN string that rotates around the S1 at constant velocity. And in fact, if you look near that limit, you can associate each of these cuts with one of the modes of the linearized fluctuation analysis around that point-like string. And in some sense, this Riemann surface describes how you take that linearized analysis into the full nonlinear regime, and it gives you a nice organization, parameterization for the space of string solutions. So morally, you can think about these string solutions as roughly being equivalent to classical solutions with a finite number of modes of the string turned on if you choose to have precisely k cuts. So it's a way of organizing the solution space of string theory.
That picture is purely classical on the world sheet, right?
That's right. Everything I've described is classical.
In quantum theory, I know the structure gets much more complicated. I mean, is there much known there? Are there tools to do
the world sheet theory? Okay, well, one thing I'm going to describe is the simplest thing, which is semi-classical quantization of the world sheet theory. So the leading order semi-classical quantization is just taking the classical system and demanding Bohr-Sommerfeld. So that corresponds to, well, once you have found the correct symplectic form, it gives you a way to quantize the moduli of this Riemann surface. It basically gives you some integrality conditions for periods. When you go beyond that, the idea is that when you fully quantize, each of these cuts breaks up into a finite set of beta roots. Although, in this particular example, that quantization has never been done from first principles. But in many other examples, it's very clear that in the quantum theory, these cuts are replaced by a finite collection of beta roots, roots of the beta ansatz. So this looks very nice as a way of just talking about general string solutions. And in fact, one can follow Kazakov et al. And turn it into a rather clean mathematical problem to characterize these families of string solutions. It's actually much harder to reconstruct the solutions themselves, but characterizing them and finding their spectrum semi-classically can be done in a fairly straightforward way as follows. That double cover of the x-plane that I defined, you can think of very conveniently as a hyperelliptic Riemann surface, and because the number of cuts was k, the genus of this Riemann surface will be k minus 1. And the key point about the double cover was it was the appropriate object on which this quasi-momentum is a well-defined object. Well, in fact, it's slightly more complicated because the quasi-momentum can jump as it lives in the exponent. It can jump by integer multiples of pi. So in fact, what you want to do to get something well-defined on the Riemann surface is think about the differential associated with the quasi-momentum. And then you get a nice well-defined problem associated with characterizing the string solutions. If you feed in the fact that you want your string solution that comes out to obey periodic boundary conditions, then this turns into conditions on the moduli of the Riemann surface. So basically they're conveniently described by saying that this dp has to have integral periods around the A and the B cycles of the Riemann surface. This is not the same as the semi-classical quantization that I just mentioned. These conditions you can count saturate some of the degrees of freedom, but in fact leave continuous moduli for this space of string solutions. So we have these conditions that we have to solve, and then in addition, as we're talking about string theory, we have to impose the Virasoro constraint. And one of the nice features of this game is that the Virasoro constraint turns into a very nice, simple condition on this differential associated with the singularity and the Lax connection. And specifically, there are second-order poles in the differential above the 2 points above each of x equals plus or minus 1. So that leads to the singularities, the punctures on the Riemann surface that I've described there. So the problem is actually to find the most general, to find for any given value of k what this family of solutions looks like. And this is where the difficulties start, basically because of this second condition here, which ties the b periods of dp to some integers. I should remark as a side, those integers have a natural interpretation also. They correspond to the corresponding mode number. In other words, if you reduce to the linearized limit, it becomes precisely the mode number associated with that particular string oscillator. But, yes?
And there's a level matching condition which sort of says that the sum of the mode numbers is...
There is one additional condition. You're right. Level matching basically is a condition on these mode numbers. Well, in fact, it involves some of the moduli as well, in fact, because level matching involves mode numbers and occupation numbers. So there is one further condition that has to be satisfied, but that's not really a problem. So this is hard because, in general, it's very easy to write down a general meromorphic differential, give it the right singularity structure. It has g degrees of freedom associated with the holomorphic differentials you can add, and you can solve some linear equations to fix the a periods. The hard thing that makes this formalism rather hard to advance is the fact that then you're stuck with these conditions, which involve some nasty hyperelliptic integrals that have to take integral values. And in general, that's the limitation to act, although those you can count the dimensionality of the solution space, and it does indeed correspond to string modes, but in terms of actually writing down specific curves which correspond to specific solutions, that life is very hard and one cannot solve these conditions in this form. So here we're not interested in the full story to get to my punchline. We're actually interested only in the large spin limit. So that turns out to be the convenient feature here. What one has to do is to scale the quasi-momentum in the appropriate way so that the spin goes to infinity. And at the same time, preserve these normalization conditions. So that's something one can take, this set of equations, and look for the corners of moduli space, if you like, where the spin becomes large. And that's what you discover some very, very nice simplifications in the problem. My first paper contained a general analysis of the problem in the limit of large spin, and the characteristic feature is this, that if you want to maintain the period conditions while taking the spin to infinity, you're driven to a very particular corner of the moduli space of this curve, where it factorizes in a specific way. The specific way is the following, that it factorizes into a smooth piece associated with has genus k minus 2, and does not contain any of the original singular points in the Lax connection, and then a piece of genus 0, which contains the singular point. So one is led to a limit in which the original differential dp had period conditions on the original curve, and now it has period conditions on these two curves, and there is one chain condition associated with the residue that you get from the period condition when you shrink that cycle to zero size. So this is where, in fact, the problem, some key simplifications occur, and it's possible use in this limit to solve the period conditions in closed form. The key simplification turns out to be that once you take this limit, the singularities in the differential end up on this piece, the double poles in the differential end up on this piece, whereas here this degeneration just leaves to some single poles in the differential, and it turns out that under those circumstances one can solve the period conditions in closed form, and find the resulting moduli space of solutions associated with the string in this limit. So specifically, one can do that, and if you write t as e to the I of the quasi-momentum on this piece, then one gets a closed formula for the curve. One can go further than that and compute the string energy by looking at the asymptotics of the differentials and extracting from them the string charge, and you find that indeed you get the K log S behavior, and you get the first subleading term rather easily in terms of the coefficients that appear here in this defining equation of the curve sigma A. It's the logarithm of the highest conserved charge. Finally, you can take the symplectic form that you get from string theory and pull it back onto the phase space and enact the corresponding Bohr-Sommerfeld conditions, which give you a quantized spectrum in the large S limit, basically by taking this auxiliary differential, which is the same thing in the connection to Seiberg-Witten theory as what's known as the Seiberg-Witten one form, and integrating it around the A cycles and equating that to an integer as it's a Bohr-Sommerfeld condition. It's telling you that you must quantize in integer units of the effective h-bar, which is 1 over square root lambda in this particular limit. So these equations together give you a complete result for the spectrum of all closed strings moving purely in ADS3 cross S1 in this limit, at least all closed strings which have this log S growth. There could be other sectors where the growth is different, but at least for the generic set of solutions that I'm looking at, for any K, one can do this analysis and find this result. And specifically, once you quantize the moduli of the Riemann surface associated with these two conditions and plug them into this formula here, you get a closed result for the entire spectrum of the string in this limit, which depends on a large set of quantum numbers. Those quantum numbers are the various integers that appear in the quantization condition. So now for the surprise. The surprise is that these equations and the spectrum is exactly the same as the corresponding spectrum of the gauge theory spin chain. And in fact, I did introduce this curve associated with the gauge theory spin chain on an earlier transparency, and I would have reminded you at this point that this is in fact the same curve that I wrote down before. I didn't show you the other formulae in the problem, but they turn out to be exactly the same as following.
Here K was just as genus, but how did you make the identification to the number of spikes?
I haven't strictly identified it in terms of the number of spikes. I'm comparing purely with the spectrum of a gauge theory spin chain of length K, right? So the identification to the number of spikes can be made by noticing that this, for a genus K minus one solution, the energy scales like K log S. Right. Although there are subsectors where you degenerate some extra handles and K is reduced to a lower integer. So in fact, this is one of a set of results which have appeared, which strongly suggests that there is some interesting matching going on between gauge theory and string theory in a rather different limit to the one that's usually considered, the limit of fixed R charge, effectively, and infinite spin. So the specific result that I described is the semi-classical spectrum of the K-gap solution goes over precisely to the semi-classical spectrum of the one-loop gauge theory spin chain. Of course, the only thing that can't literally be true about that is the overall coupling constant dependence. And as usual, the one loop factor lambda is replaced by the appropriate square root lambda factor. And of course, the natural conjecture is that what we're talking about here is some situation where we have a function, probably the cusp anomalous dimension, if you match onto the twist 2 case, which interpolates between these two factors. But the key feature is that the evidence is here that the whole spectrum in this particular limit basically goes over with a single renormalization, a single prefactor. Of course, we haven't proved that. All we've done is compare the actual spectra at large lambda and small lambda and found this agreement. We can't guarantee that something crazy doesn't happen in between. So this is very much in the same spirit as, it's been known, in fact, for twist 2 operators, there are indirect arguments that show that in the infinite spin limit, so-called wrapping corrections are suppressed, and that you should find an absence of corrections to the naive beta ansatz result that you get from the asymptotic beta ansatz. And if you were to assume that something similar was going on here, it would provide an absence of wrapping corrections in the this limit would provide an explanation of this matching. But what I want to do just in the closing minutes is just describe how one can interpret it in terms of the spikes and their dynamics. So specifically here, just to close this part, the claim was that out of string theory you get not just the curve, but everything you need to compute the spectrum, specifically the Hamiltonian, the order log s and the order s to the zero piece, and importantly, it's important to add that you have to use the correct symplectic form, the one that you get from the string theory Lagrangian. So, of course, what we'd like to do is interpret this in the following way. The fact that these solutions scale like K log S, it tempts you to say that it should be the case that generic K-gap solutions in the limit where spin goes to infinity develop K-spikes, and those K-spikes approach the boundary, giving you the K log S divergence. Then it would be very natural to assume that this leading piece, which matches on both sides, which corresponds to the dynamics of the spin chain, classical spin chain on the gauge theory side, is somehow describing the leading correction, the slow motion of the spiky degrees of freedom in the strict limit everything is frozen and the points hit the boundary and the Hamiltonian is the same for all states, but at the first subleading order this log Q of K gives you some slow dynamics for the degrees of freedom of the string. So one can actually make a case this is what's going on. This, of course, is less precise than the example that I just described. In particular, if you look at the known spiky string solutions, you discover that something quite striking is happening here, which indicates that there might be a very direct connection to the quanta of the dual gauge theory and the dual spin chain language. Specifically, if you consider the known spiky string solutions, and you take the limit where the spin goes to infinity, and you look at what happens to the worldsheet current, the worldsheet charge density, which is perfectly smooth even though the string has cusps. But when you take the limit that the spin goes to infinity, what happens is in the existing known solutions, where the spikes are at the vertices of a polygon, something striking happens. The charge density becomes delta function localized at the cusps of the string in this limit, and there is some prefactor here which belongs to SL2R. And it's very natural to suspect that the correct map between the gauge theory and the spin chain degrees of freedom is that somehow we should associate this prefactor of the delta function here, which lives in the Lie algebra of SL2R, with the classical limit of the spins that appear in the dual gauge theory. And indeed, one can do some initial calculations with these generic solutions that tend to back up that picture. So we believe that that is actually the correct relation between the degrees of freedom of the spiky string and those of the dual gauge theory. One can go a little bit further than that and actually look at the strict limit where the spikes touch the boundary and calculate the spectral curve for these string solutions just directly, just by localizing, using the fact that the charge densities are all localized, and one can actually show that you get the right curve and that these, if you in the limit, you're going to get a bunch of string solutions where the endpoints touch the boundary and you have variable separations. The separation can be anything you like once you actually take this limit where the endpoints touch the boundary. So one can relate those to the curves of the to the conserved quantities of the curves that I wrote down, and you find an explicit expression in terms of the angular separation for the moduli of the string. So the idea is somehow that this is the equation that I wrote down on the previous transparency is actually giving you some kind of a precise map between the dynamics of the gauge theory spins and the dynamics of these cusps. But there's clearly more work to be done here to actually look at the actual solutions reconstructed from the Riemann surface and look at them in more detail. So just to finish off now, as I'm running out of time, let me just say a few words. I mean, there's a lot I could say about things that are still to be done. One point I should go back to is the fact that there is something to be explained here about the agreement between one-loop gauge theory and string theory. The fact that we have found that there are no, corrections, evidence for the fact that there is the only correction is an overall normalization of the spectrum as a whole in this limit. So from the language of the standard asymptotic beta ansatz, which I remind you, corresponds to an infinitely long spin chain, so a priori it's a long, long way away from the things that I'm considering here. In that standard language, it has to do with whether or not there are finite J corrections or not to the leading order J goes to infinity results. And I believe that this kind of result could be understood if it was true that there were no wrapping corrections in the limits of large spin for generic observables. Another connection it would be like nice to make more precisely is to the work of Alday and Maldacena, where light like Wilson loops play a key role in determining the scattering amplitudes of gluons in the gauge theory. Clearly should be some connection here. The connection is known for the case of the lowest state of lowest twist. The Alday-Maldacena light-like Wilson loop can be realized, or it's the world sheet can be realized as an analytic continuation of the GKP string to Euclidean world sheet. So it's very suggestive here that there should be some connection between these strings with more spikes, more quanta in them, and scattering amplitudes with more gluons in them. So some kind of analytic continuation is suggested. I should say that there are other interesting limits you could consider here, and one that I'm working on is a limit suggested by Kruschensky et al., where you take the number of spikes to infinity and focus on a patch near the boundary, where you essentially go over from string theory in global coordinates to string theory in the Poincaré patch. It's not quite that, because in fact, taking the limit, you get a sort of ADS-PP wave that is dual to the gauge theory on a particular PP wave background. So my belief is that a similar phenomenon occurs here, and one finds the leading order in this PP wave limit, that the dynamics of the string is described by some finite degrees of freedom associated with the cusps. And I'm hoping this is perhaps going to give me some way of thinking about an integrable DLCQ for string theory in the Poincaré patch, but that's an idea that's in construction, a long, long way away from actual realization. So I should say that's it.
More questions?
Could you say more about that identification of the L's or the curly L's?
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, okay, so perhaps I'll go back, as I think you weren't here for the first part of the talk, which I reviewed the story of the gauge theory in the limit of large spin. So the standard spin chain picture, where you have spin operators, gets replaced by a classical picture when the spin goes to infinity and these SL2R spins are very highly excited. So you get some variables L, which are the kind of classical limits of the spin operators. They obey the Poisson brackets, or the algebra of SL2R. And the whole gauge theory spectrum can be described in terms of a classical spin chain, where you have nearest neighbor interactions. So specifically, I don't have the right slide to hand, but the key point was that the solution of this classical spin chain goes over one-to-one to the solution of the string in this particular limit. And my belief is that one can actually make that matching, and we've done some simple tests of this. If you identify these classical spins with the leading coefficient of the delta function at the spike as that point approaches the boundary. But I think we need to do some more work to make that actually...
They're the same Poisson brackets among themselves.
They do, yes. They're inherited. Yes. So the whole structure coincides. I mean, so I should say that, well, precisely what you can do is to take those delta functions and work out the curve, and then work out the Hamiltonian in terms of the curve, and that agrees. But it implies this agreement. It implies an agreement of the full structure, in fact, in this limit. Yeah, the idea is, yes, that just when they're a little bit in from the boundary, they have some slow dynamics, and that can really be matched to the other picture I showed was the fact that in the quant in the S3, that you can really think about these states as corresponding to some highly excited quanta on S3. So somehow you can match the dynamics between both sides.
Say it again for a quick.